Good evening to Europe, good morning to Asia, and good afternoon to those all across the Fruited Plains. You are tuned in to the global leader in conscious radio programming, bbsradio.com, and you are now locked in to the worldwide 20 megabit beacon of truth, hope, and justice, otherwise known as your weekly dose of the Crimson Pill. I, your host, the great and all-powerful Antonin Fiore, hey, just make sure you don't peek behind the curtain, folks, encourage you to unfasten your seatbelts and turn on all portable electronic devices as we embark on this week's voyage of the USS Crimson Pill. Our course has been charted for the Isle of Light by way of the Straits of Knowledge and the Sea of Tranquility. In the event of turbulence, the captain reminds you that your biological seat cushion is no substitute for an open mind. If you are seated in an exit row, you are now invited to move forward to our first class cabin of truth at any time. Ladies and gentlemen of the Crimson Pill listening audience, it is a real pleasure for me to introduce our next guest. On today's show, we've been talking about preparedness, any number of different eventualities or events that could happen in any one of our given parts of the world, our neck of the woods. And to help us explore some of these important considerations about preparedness, I've invited a listener of the program to be our feature guest today. Ms. Nia Ruiz has been working in the field of medicine for the past 8 years and is currently working as a credentialed surgical technologist. While working full-time in the field, Nia is also pursuing coursework in pre-medicine, with her career objective of becoming a physician in naturopathic medicine or perhaps a medical scientist in astrobiology or neurocognitive sciences. Ms. Ruiz has written to me by email, it was just a short time back actually, and she offered a suggestion about having a discussion about preparedness as one of the topics for our show. And folks, as we communicated back and forth with messages, it was very easy for me to tell, readily apparent, that she's invested a good deal of time and energy thinking about some of these essential considerations that go into being prepared, whether it's just yourself as an individual in your home, or whether you have to think about preparedness for your entire family. So at this time, folks, it is truly a privilege and a pleasure for me to introduce Ms. Nia Ruiz. And Nia, are you there on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, Nia, first of all, welcome to the program. I hope you're in the middle of an excellent day. And how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you so much for having me.
Great. Now, Nia, you're joining us from Florida, I believe. Is that right?
That is correct, South Florida.
And I'm guessing that when you grow up in South Florida, you know, what with patterns of hurricanes and whatnot, you probably have a lot of history on your mind about the importance of preparedness, but I don't want to make that assumption for you, but would that be fair to say?
That would be fair to say. We go through any number of hurricanes often here in Florida, so yes.
And is that part of how you first started thinking about preparedness, or maybe some other, you know, factors in there as well? How did you first really kind of get thinking about being prepared?
I kind of stumbled upon it. I'm kind of like a sponge. I want to know about everything. And so when I was doing some research on just regular stuff and stuff for school, I just happened to stumble upon one thing, and then it led into the other, and then the other, and then, you know, all of a sudden I know a little bit about basically everything about preparedness, not to mention my training and things like that. So it kind of all comes together.
I can imagine that through the course of your, not just your university coursework, but also in your profession, you're maybe kind of given reminders about how important it can be to be prepared. Almost every day you probably are coming across information of that sort.
Oh my goodness, yes. Especially in the hospital scene, it's so important. Safety is everything, and being prepared, you know, they have disaster preparedness, you know, just manuals and books and series, and you have to go to conferences and all sorts of things that you have to do.
Absolutely.
So, yes.
And unfortunately, again, as part of your career in the medical field, you probably see the results of some folks who weren't as prepared as what they maybe should have been for certain eventualities.
That's true. It's not a pretty thing. I mean, a lot of times you see, like, especially when it comes to, and I'm not going to digress too far into that, but, you know, people that don't prepare just with life in general, you know, people that don't have insurance and stuff like that too, you know, they come in and they have all these medical issues and they have no way to pay for it and they have no idea what to do or how to do it, but they're sick and, you know, they're just, it's sad.
Yes, yeah, I can imagine. Along with maybe the ideas of even having some basic or inexpensive, simple things in the household or available at close hand, in the car, for example, maybe just a simple medical kit. Sometimes it seems like some relatively inexpensive measures that we could take for preparedness. If we had those available, it could help in some of those extreme emergencies, because by the time a person makes it to the hospital, for example, sometimes there's already been a loss of blood and some other issues that have become more complicated than maybe they could have been. Is that fair to say?
That is very fair to say. I couldn't agree more. I make sure that I have a first aid kit in my car as well as my sister's car and, you know, my friend's cars and everybody. I try and make sure that everybody's prepared.
Sure, exactly. Well, you know, one of the first things that caught my attention in when you sent a message to me with the idea for the show talking about preparedness is you actually demonstrated an awareness of a range of different types of emergencies and or disasters or catastrophes. It's really not just hurricanes, for example. And so if a person doesn't live in South Florida, there's no hurricanes, they have nothing to worry about. That's really not the case, is it? Could you maybe take a moment and sort of, you know, describe the landscape of some of these different considerations where, you know, an ounce of preparedness could be worth a pound of value later?
Sure, most definitely. As with hurricanes and things like that, you know, preparedness is basic, you know, just water, food, and just your basic stable shelter. Things along the lines of tornadoes, other things such as biological warfare, asteroids, comets, tidal waves, because on the East Coast we call them tidal waves, just a whole range of things, nuclear meltdowns, because here in Florida we have a lot of nuclear power plants here, so that's another consideration for a lot of people, not just in Florida.
Sure.
You know, just seismic activity, volcanic activity, you know, fault lines, things like that. You know, there's a whole wider range of things to take into consideration, and a lot of people don't think along those lines. I'm constantly thinking in a worst-case scenario, you know, premise kind of thing. So,
in your profession, I'm sure that's very important, actually, to kind of look at things in that way. And you've made a very good list of these considerations. In fact, you know, if I just ask our listening audience to think about maybe some of these events that have happened in your own backyard just in this past year alone, or if you've been in a relatively quiet part of the world, just think about the headlines from across the United States, the record-setting number of and damage done by tornadoes ranging across what we think of as the tornado belt, you know, starting kind of around Oklahoma, that ballpark, but then spreading through the Southeast. And we had the horrendous wildfires in the Southwest. Oftentimes those make their way through parts of California as well. I think New Mexico was of greatest concern in these recent months. Look at all the flooding. If you're anywhere in the Midwest, if you're along the Missouri River, you know just how powerful the damage of flooding can be. And in fact, I actually live in an area that last year we had relatively minor flooding occur in our area, and yet there was just a coincidental break in a water main that supplied the city's main water system. And because of the flooding, that contaminated the water supply. And so this city that I'm at, which is a relatively, you know, average-sized American city with a large university, it was without water for a span of about 5 days. And that's kind of unexpected out of the middle of nowhere. So there really is a tremendous range of considerations that people ought to think about, isn't there?
That's true. I think that a lot of things happen throughout the United States and other places as well, and a lot of people are just not aware because it doesn't hit close to home. And I think that, you know, sometimes no one ever thinks that it's going to happen to them, you know, until it
right.
does.
Right.
And then people are caught off guard.
Yeah, exactly.
And unprepared.
There you have it, exactly. So I am again so thankful, Nia, that you've joined our program today so we can actually talk through some of these particulars. We'll now, folks, start to dive into the weeds, if you will, talking about some of the steps that you can take, again, whether it's just yourself or whether you have your whole family to consider. But Nia is going to help me kind of walk through some of these ideas of consideration. And Nia, maybe if I can ask you this question. What steps do you think that an average individual or family could begin to take right away, some things they could start to do today, for example, to make sure that they're prepared for these unexpected things?
Well, I think the most important thing to do is, what I would tell everybody to do is do your homework. Definitely do your homework. Do as much research as possible. That way, each person can identify exactly what kinds or types of situations that they want to get themselves prepared for. Because if everybody's in disagreement, you know, in the family, or if you're not sure what you need to be prepared for, then you don't know what you need. And then you can prepare accordingly once you've established, okay, you know, let's say, for example, I want to be prepared for an earthquake, biological warfare, and a comet. So then you know what you need. If you want to, you know, in an ideal world, we would all want to be fully prepared for everything, but
sure, yep.
That's not exactly the world that we live in.
It's kind of it's a little cost prohibitive also to maybe try to be prepared for everything. Is that
exactly?
Fair?
So my suggestion to, you know, the average Joe and Jane would be just to prepare as much as you can with the resources that you have to work with. Sit down, create a plan, or set a goal. You know, set a goal with an exit strategy and a time frame. You know, once you have a rough sketch, or so to speak, you can have something to work with from there. You can create a budget. You can make lists of things that you need. You can get organized. You can figure out what you're going to do. And so if something happens, you know what you're going to do. You're not stumbling around trying to save your family or yourself or, you know, just your girlfriend, your dog, whatever. You can, you know, you can, like I said, you can start by doing research and educating yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Nia.
No, that's okay.
It doesn't hurt to maybe put pen to paper also, right? To actually put some thoughts down and make some notes that you've got that you can refer to, because just in case, for example, let's say you are the mother or the father of your family, and let's say that you've been the one spearheading your family's preparedness. Unfortunately, let's say something unexpected or unfortunate happens to you, that might be like losing the lifeline for the whole family. So whatever I believe that a person feels is important enough to begin preparing for, it's also important enough to maybe capture a written record or outline or plan for that information as well.
I couldn't agree more. And you know what? That's a great analogy. You know, a lot of people, they buy car insurance. They buy health insurance. They buy homeowners insurance. They buy life insurance. But nobody ever takes insurance for their family's safety. Truly. I mean,
yes. Yep.
If you think about it in those terms, nobody ever really does. Very few people do, I should say that.
I think you're exactly right. Yeah. It's the cost of getting some, for example, basic first aid kit and other type of materials set aside. I believe that cost, having done some of this planning and purchasing some of these things for myself, I realize firsthand that pales in comparison to what the cost is involved with car insurance, homeowners insurance, and what you've said. I think you're right on track, Nia.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the big things with what I would tell families to do is first to figure out, like I said, what you want to be prepared for. You know, what your beliefs are, what you think might happen, because everybody's opinion on that is, you know, differs greatly. So I think that what everybody can agree on is that they need to find safe shelter or a safe zone, something that can, you know, protect them and their family from a variety of different hazards. And I think that that is the most important consideration throughout the whole thing that we're going to be talking about, is finding a place to be that's going to be safe.
I think that's such a great point, because I think so many of us assume that in the event of, let's say, tornadoes, or, you know, as unexpected or unlikely as maybe nuclear reactor meltdown and committing radiation that follows, as unlikely as that is, we've seen that happen also just in the last several months. Farther back in history, Chernobyl, it happened there as well. But people need to think in terms that it's not necessarily the case that there's going to be a shelter or a safe place that you can get to within minutes of your home. You might need to do the planning to think about safe locations or safe zones. Maybe it is in connection with some family or friends, but that are at varying distances away from your home. Not just one, but maybe multiple that are at you know, farther and farther distances away. How do you feel along those lines, Nia?
I think that that's a great thing to take into consideration, because, you know, I don't know about a lot of other states, but I know here in Florida, you know, if something were to happen here, I mean, we have, this place is just not a safe place to be, I'll put it that way. I'm just going to give you an example. You know, Florida, it's beautiful here year round, but you know, like you know already, we have hurricanes, which, you know, like I was telling you earlier, that anything under a Category 3, everybody here kind of blows it off, and it's like, oh well, it's kind of a party. We'll do a barbecue, you know. And but you know, anything other than that. Within a 100-mile radius, north and south of me, I have nuclear power plants. I have several military bases around here, and to the east of me, I'm less than 20 minutes away from the ocean. Uh-huh. You know, Florida's a peninsula. It's surrounded by water on three sides, you know, and not only that, but Florida is a very, very long state.
Yes.
So it makes, you know, this place kind of dangerous.
It's fairly vulnerable,
isn't
it?
Say the least.
Yep. Yes, yep. And quite a high percentage of the U.S. population actually does live right along coastline areas. We've already seen some of the impact and consequence of that with Hurricane Katrina, as an example. But living along those coastlines presents a key vulnerability that I think goes right back to your point about one of the first and most important considerations being safe zones and your plan of how to get out of your current area and to a safer point.
That's true. You know, I think that it's really important also to have an exit strategy, because you can have a safe place, but if you have no way to get there on a moment's notice, then you're kind of, it's kind of moot.
That's an excellent point. Can you talk a little bit more about this idea of the exit strategy? What's some of the planning that should go into to that sort of notion?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, when people, or, you know, the health department kind of tells you to be prepared for fires or, you know, things like that. Have an exit strategy for your house just in case of emergencies. Well, it kind of works the same way. You definitely want to have an exit strategy to leave in case of any kind of catastrophe or social upheaval, you know, because anarchy is not totally out of the question, neither is martial law or anything like that. You know, you just have to take everything into consideration and kind of plan a way to get out. I mean, that's really important when it comes to people depending on you to be, you know, to get to safety. It becomes important at that point.
Quite right. Very well said. And I think maybe a couple of those examples of some of the particular things to plan for there would be having maps prepared that show your not just your primary route, but as we've seen in the case of Katrina, for example, where the highways become so congested so quickly when many people are trying to move, that you really should have a secondary and tertiary and maybe even more alternative routes available. Is that fair to say?
That is absolutely correct. Like I said before, I'm sure I've said it plenty of times now, you have to really take everything into consideration when you think of a plan that in-depth to have, secondary and tertiary and, plans in place just in case the first and second ones go wrong.
Exactly.
But, that's the reality. Reality is, part of the problem is that people are so caught up in day-to-day life, they don't want to really think about, things happening like that. They kind of, it's kind of a psychological thing, too. It's protective, They're mm-hmm. protecting them, themselves to, to do that. But you're right about preparing with maps. Also, backups of gasoline if you're doing, a vehicle. Also, you probably want to consider having a large vehicle to pack as many people or as many supplies as you can. Maybe if you know somebody, that's a pilot or has a private airplane or a boat or whatever, then that might also be something, a train, whatever you might be able to consider to modes of transportation, I should say.
You've made so many great points there, Nia. I just hope to recap a little. Yes, absolutely. What vehicle or vehicles will you plan to use to move out? Are the vehicles large enough to transport not just the people involved, but also some of those essential materials that you want to take with you? And here in just a bit, folks, Nia and I are going to do a real thorough breakdown of exactly what some of those materials are, food and supplies and et cetera. We'll get into those details here in just a bit. But also, with those vehicles, do you have enough gas? Folks, how many of us, on a day-to-day basis, we drive and we drive until the fuel reading is on empty, and then we barely make it into the gas station on fumes. But if we're in the midst of an emergency, will we have access to that gas station, or will the line be a mile long? So do you have some extra fuel, maybe a couple small tanks at the very least, that you keep stored at your home or at some safe place so that you'll have some backup? There are even folks that I know of today that, as a rule of thumb, they never allow their gas tank to get below, let's say, 40% when it reaches that
like
point.
My mother.
I'll take that as a compliment, Nia.
That is.
Thank you. So continuing along with some of those thoughts, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but if you'll kind of keep moving along with that idea of an exit plan, an exit strategy, and these considerations.
Yes, of course. One of the things I wanted to add to what you were saying that you made a great point about, having the gas, I think that if people have the ability to invest in maybe perhaps like an older diesel vehicle, a diesel vehicle is a great thing to have because if for whatever reason you had no access to gasoline, you could always fuel your car with an alternative diesel fuel that you prepared yourself or, that you could get from some sort of natural materials.
Excellent considerations.
That's a good thing to have.
Those, yes, excellent thoughts, Nia. In fact, it causes me to think about some of the programming that I've seen on television. I think it's the History Channel and History International, Discovery Channel, the Science Channel. There's really been some very informative programming over the course of the last couple of years. In particular, there's one show, and goodness, now I'm struggling to recollect it, of course, at a moment's notice, but it's where they had some survivors of a calamity. It's kind of set up like an experiment where they were trying to survive post-apocalyptic events.
I think the show was called Survivors or something along those lines. I know what you're talking about.
I promise the audience I'm going to find that information before our interview is done. But they do make a very good exposition of some of the steps you take, like how do you take water from a river or a stream and at least perform some of the basic filtration required to make that water safe to drink. Merely boiling it alone is really not sufficient to make it truly potable or consumable. And along those lines, referring back to Nia's example, I've also seen some of the programming where they illustrate, they demonstrate the steps needed to take something like used cooking grease from restaurants, from fast food restaurants, or et cetera, and making that usable in a diesel-based engine so that you can run it through your automobile when there's not, as Nia had mentioned, access to typical gasoline or to traditional diesel. How to use something like used cooking oil and grease as a fuel source.
That's absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I think there's a family in California that has a urban homestead that I've heard of that they make their own biodiesel fuel there as well. So I thought that was absolutely fascinating, you know, not only from recycled vegetable oils, but things like soybeans. There's a couple of guys that made their own company providing soybean diesel, you know, like a diesel out of soybeans. I thought that was fascinating as well. But I believe you can derive it from some kind of garbage as well, if I'm not mistaken. But don't quote me on that.
Well, I've seen some information along those lines also. So, yes, I think you're right on track.
So, yeah, I think that, like I said, you know, obviously buying a brand new diesel car is not necessary. But if you can, you know, diesel's pretty expensive right now. So if you can manage to get your hands on maybe an older model, you know, SUV that's diesel or something like that, that might come in very useful.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, Nia, thus far we've talked about identifying safe zones or safe locations. If you're in the middle of an urban center, for example, where should you try to distance yourself from that location where maybe the calamity is happening? Do you have plans, alternate routes in place? We've talked a little about the transportation itself, the vehicle. Is it large enough, safe enough? Do you have fuel to make that trip? I wonder now if we should talk a bit about communication also and challenges that people might experience with communication lines that we've become accustomed to having so conveniently right now.
Well, like I said before, I always think in terms of worst-case scenario. So in my mind, lack of communication would involve satellites falling from the sky. And absolutely no communication, no internet, no cell phone service. I think the only thing that might be a viable means for communication would be along the lines of, you know, maybe a radio or Morse code, you know, basically.
Sure.
But, you know, somewhere along those lines, I think communication would be a real issue to take into consideration. So if you have extended family or, you know, something along those lines, I would try and think of something creative to leap over that hurdle.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, on this very radio show, but outside of our pre-recording that we're making now, we've talked about solar flares, coronal mass ejections, and the challenges that those could impose upon us in terms of not just communication, but anything perhaps electrical that we've come to rely on in history. For example, in 1859, there took place a solar flare that's referred to as the Carrington event. And at that time, it was powerful enough to take telegraph lines and set them on fire. There was so much energy that telegraphs were able to function even with their batteries disconnected because of residual power in the lines. But much more recently, we've seen also, as a result of solar flares, we've seen outages of communication because those flares can be damaging to satellites. They can, they can literally make them unfunctional. They can fry them in common parlance. We've also seen solar flares powerful enough to cause brownouts and electrical shortages because they cause damage to electrical grids here on Earth. And it is projected that if we had another solar flare of the same strength, the same power, the same energetic result as the Carrington event of 1859, it is projected that that could cause us to be without any electronic functionality for potentially months on end. So, folks, that means no cell phones, that means no internet, no computers, potentially that powerful, potentially that sweeping. And so Nia's points here about having some strategies in mind of how you can communicate with family, friends, your loved ones, however distant they might be, it is very important to think about some of these things. Do you still have a landline, for example, or did you give that away because of the convenience of the cell phone? Some of these ideas about how you communicate with your loved ones in advance, once again, an hour's worth of preparation today could be worth weeks' worth of stress, worry, concern, and lack of communication at some time in the future when we least expect it. Any thoughts there, Nia?
Yes. You know, when you were talking about being without power for months, you know, we Floridians, we know all about that. Every time we get hit with a hurricane, as a matter of fact, a few years ago, we got the year that Katrina hit, as a matter of fact, we got hit with Katrina as well, although Katrina, when it hit here, was not as strong. But we got smacked back-to-back with four hurricanes that year, one after the other.
Oh,
and, my house, we didn't have electricity for about 2 months straight. And that says a lot when you can't refrigerate your food or take a hot shower or take a shower, because we have well water, so, you know, we didn't have an electrical pump to use it, so we had to go to my parents' house to to take a cold shower. And, you know, gas as well, you know, you have to think about that. These pumps are electrical. A lot of these gas stations just had no gas to provide, so you had to definitely strategize where you were going and make sure that the trip was worth it. As well as you have to take into consideration hospitals. Their generators only last so long. You know, if power's out everywhere for 2 months, there's going to be a lot of casualties. You know, just hospitals' generators, they can't function that long without, you know, without electricity. I mean, just think of the massive amounts of electricity that they use on a daily basis, and you would be surprised.
So you're absolutely right. There are so many of those layers of interdependence that our society has come to rely on. Many people in business today, you've heard the philosophy of just-in-time delivery of supplies, components, resources necessary for production. Well, folks, unfortunately, that mentality has made its way back upstream in every avenue of life. So many hospitals, for example, yes, they have temporary generation of electricity resources on hand, but yet how about the fuel that's going to supply that, and how long will the disruption of services or availability of these supply lines, how long will those things last such that Nia's comments that she's made here most recently come into play? It has become such an intricately interwoven chain of supply and demand for that reason that we don't realize just how vulnerable we are at some of these critical bottlenecks or pinch points of our key infrastructure and also the services that support and keep us healthy and keep us fed along the line. Your thoughts there, Nia?
One thing I just wanted to add to that was when I was talking about water, another thing when the power goes out is the water plant's ability to filter and clean the water. So essentially, the water that you may get may not be a sanitary enough water to drink. It may be okay to bathe in or wash clothes or whatnot, but not so much to drink or to cook with. So that's another thing, and you're absolutely right about the hospitals, because, you know, they are prepared, and not even all hospitals have backup generators. A lot of places, you know, a more not so urban places, they don't necessarily have backup generators. So, I mean, they would be completely in the dark without the ability to keep people on respirators or have a defibrillator, you know, usage or anything to keep people alive, they would not be able to use. So I think that that's a really big issue. And, again, communication. How would emergency services be able to reach people that really needed it? You know, it would not be an easy thing to attempt.
Oh, you've made some very, very astute and important points once again, Nia. And I appreciate the time and the research that you've put into some of these considerations. I know that's going to be helpful for us as we continue the conversation hear with some of the real details. Like, I guess what I'm hoping to do right now, Nia, is between you and I, as we're visiting, and some folks who are listening to the show, folks, I would encourage you, break out a blank sheet of paper and start making some notes now about some of the real key things, basic things, things you can start with today. And I think Nia already touched upon one of those. That's water supply. What would you do if suddenly there were no water coming from your tap? And as I mentioned, that happened in my city, relatively modern, if you want to call it, or average-sized city, just last year. Unexpectedly, we had no city-supplied water supply for about 5 days. What would you do when that happens? Nia, do you have some thoughts on water that people should begin to think about and maybe start their planning or research about their own personal water supply?
Some people may have the means to invest in a distiller, but if you don't have that kind of money to spend on a distiller, if you know anybody that's really handy and inventive, you know, it's not that difficult to really build an average run-of-the-mill distiller. Basically, just heat to metal and water and another container at the other end. You know, I think that that could be a viable means to kind of, you know, provide drinking water. But another thing, you know, for people that don't want to go through all that, you can buy just gallons of water or larger amounts of water. Even some websites provide those large water container bins.
Yes,
and they're not
yeah.
so bad in price. They're
right.
affordable.
And in fact, even just buying like what we call flats of water, which is, 12 to 24 bottles, shrink wrapped in a flat, average drinking size type water bottles. But in my view, those are so inexpensive at the store. You might find those flats of water for, three or no more than $4 for a flat. When so many of us walk into a convenience store and pay $1.50 for bottled water, you can have 12 to 24 bottles for $3 to $4. And it's my view that people should have at least one or two of those flats for each member of the family that they just keep in storage, and you gradually use them and replace that over time as you're using them. And Nia, also to your point about water distillation, I've also recently come across another option, and in fact I've made the purchase. Folks, the brand is called Berkey Water Filtration, B-E-R-K-E-Y, I believe it is, or maybe it's just Y at the end. And we purchased one of their, actually, I think it's their most inexpensive unit. It's called a Berkey Light. It's made of plastic. It's very quickly and easily disassembled, so you can move it. Many folks take these when they go on camping trips, for example. What's so wonderful about it is it uses a water filtration system that you can take water directly from a stream or a river, even, and without needing to boil it, you can run it through its filtration system and have potable drinking water in just the course of a short period of time. So there are options like that available. And the last one that came to mind to me, and as I promised, listening audience, your humble host always delivers, the name of that television show on the Discovery Channel was The Colony. And what drew me to that show, if you do a Google search for The Colony TV show, Discovery Channel, what drew me to that, I was impressed by, is they include additional information on that website, which gets into some of these steps of preparedness in a very detailed fashion. They have some white papers, they have forums where people discuss some of these survival techniques, how to live off the grid. If you don't have something like a Berkey water filtration system, how can you take a bucket down to the river, bring it back? It's not sufficient just to boil it, folks. There is also a little bit more involved. You want to use some charcoal and sand and drain it through that to help get some of the impurities out, to some of the actually some of the bacteria, some of the little bugs. But these are some of those consideration, folks, that I would, if you have time, research all of these options. But at the very least, start today or tomorrow, the next trip to your grocery store, buy a couple flats of water so that you at least have the beginnings of your preparedness plan. Nia, did I maybe leave anything out, or would you make any changes to some of those thoughts?
No, I think you did a great job. I might want to add, when people take or learn about survival techniques, you know, for people that go camping or people that are just survivalists or people that just like to go out in the wilderness, you should always, you know how they always talk about being prepared and whatnot, emergency worst-case scenarios. So they teach you how to filter water from streams and stuff like that, you know, with what you have. And so I think that that's an excellent point that you make. There are several options to create viable drinking water. I mean, not just those two, but I mean, definitely I want to encourage everybody listening to definitely do their research. I mean, there's, like I said, a lot of options to work with.
Once again, you make very, very salient points, Nia, along those lines. You know, folks, this process of preparedness, once again, if you are the head of the household for your family, please keep in mind that you acquiring and setting aside some of these things is only just part of what preparedness really means. Think about your children. Do they possess the skills themselves to be able to continue their process of getting along in the unfortunate eventuality that maybe something happens to you or to your spouse? Are they equipped with the knowledge and the skills that it takes to be prepared? And as Nia has pointed out, there are many resources. Sometimes it's classes. It might be first aid class in preparedness, or in your local community, there may be folks who are putting on workshops related to, you know, survivalism, if it's on a camping trip, that sort of thing. And then also remember, ladies and gentlemen, with the power of the internet, the world is at your fingertips. And I've made mention of just one program. That's the Colony TV show on this Discovery Channel, where with their website, they offer so many tremendous resources. It's not just video clips from the show, folks. There's a lot of white papers and other detailed information here that, you know, if the day comes when the power goes out or the internet goes out, it's too late to try to access those. Spend a few minutes, go there now, print some of these things out so you have hard copy references that you can refer to just in case those lights go out. Nia, tell me, some more thoughts along these lines?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I think that you made excellent points. You know, I couldn't have said it better myself. You couldn't be more correct, because the minute the power goes out, none of the things that you think you've learned, you will have access to. So, I mean, just everything is so great, we can just save it to our favorites or, you know, just refer back to it if we need it. But if the power goes out, all of that is useless. So it's really important to keep hard copies of everything. And in that respect, I was going to mention e-books online.
Ah,
e-books are
excellent.
A great thing, because you can buy e-books at a reduced rate compared to an actual copied book in the store. But the great thing about e-books is you can save it to an external drive of some sort, and you can print it out, or you can print out only the pages that you think are important, or you can copy it for friends and family. Not that that's probably legal, but, you know, it's an option. And, you know, as well as you can put it in a book accumulated with other sorts of how-tos and information and stuff like that, and create your own survival manual. I think that that's good to make a copy, to have one at home, one in the car, just in case, and, you know, maybe one at work or, you know, at your shelter if you have one already, or a designated place. I think that those are great options. Also, you're right about the internet. I mean, there are so many websites. You know, people can join survival groups online. I mean, you would be surprised how many families are really on there. You know, people with children that are concerned about the safety of their family. You know, single people, they just want to make sure that, you know, they have a way to get to safety if they can. Or, you know, people with disabilities, people with health issues, you know, just a wide a range of people are online, and, you know, you can chat with them. People have great ideas. You can brainstorm. People get creative when it comes to survival things. And I think that that's a great thing also to keep in mind. You know, you're not limited to what we have in society. You can make your own things. You know, sometimes those things are better. So I think that that will help as well.
Excellent, excellent points, Nia. Maybe some examples along those lines. How many of us have the skills where we can sew, where we can repair, you know, tears or holes that have been made in our clothing? How many of us can make a new garment, you know, make a new shirt from scrap materials? Do we have our sewing skills, our chops up to date? How many of us are prepared to try to, you know, prepare some meals from scratch? For example, when's the last time that you made a loaf of bread from scratch? Some of these types of ideas, considerations, I think, go right to Nia's point about the resources that we have available today in this wonderful information age with the power of the Internet. But again, if that power goes out, we lose access to some of those. And Nia, another point that you had made is some of these groups, you know, whether they're you know, groups of like-minded folks that maybe you can access or figure out more information again from the Internet. I think you'd referenced one of those in our communication. Is it Vivos, Terra Vivos? Could you talk about that for a moment?
Terra Vivos is an organization that offers a safe zone or a safe haven for people. They do charge, and they're a little expensive, but doing some research, I mean, they are a great organization, or they seem that way at least, and they provide everything that you could possibly think of. I went through their whole website, and I just thought, like, wow, it would take a family just about forever to be as prepared as they have. They've literally thought of every scenario, and they have even little icons with pictures at the bottom for every, like, catastrophe scenario and stuff like that.
Cool.
So they charge, I think it is now, $9,950.
Oh, my goodness.
Per their website, per person.
Wow.
And that's for economy class. However, they do have a facility. They have medical facilities, decontamination facilities. Their bunkers are solar flare-proof, nuclear warfare-proof, biological and chemical warfare-proof, you know, comet,
sure.
You know, and asteroid striking resistant, or, you know, that to that level, their extinction level event preparedness, basically.
Yeah.
And they even have a cryo center that they're producing kind of like a Noah's Ark kind of a thing, where they're storing DNA and eggs and stuff, which I think is great, you know. But
yes.
The cost that it would take for a family to prepare to that magnitude, which are things that you would need, not to mention physical contact with other people and maybe help from, you know, others that are more knowledgeable than yourself, I think that would just take an enormous amount of money for one and effort on the other hand as well. So I think if you compare them, if you don't have the ability to really create your own bunker or safe haven or whatnot from extreme levels of catastrophe, if you believe that that's going to happen, then Terra Vivos is a great option.
Sure.
I really think so.
And folks, I do want to make mention, this is most definitely not a paid advertisement or even just commercial placement for this organization.
That's correct, because they are not paying me to tell them, to tell anybody about them.
And they're definitely not paying me either. I just found it to be a very good example of a resource that is available on the Internet. And folks, it's just one example. There are many different networks of folks that are working on a nonprofit basis, but networks of folks who are trying to share information. They're trying to compare best practices and ideas that they're using and taking and working with themselves. And so this is one example. If you go to that website, Terra Vivos, it might give you some thoughts to help construct your own planning for your family. But once again, neither Nia nor myself are paid spokespeople for that organization. So we'll close our discussion of them for the moment. So Nia, kind of thinking again about the essentials, the basics. We've talked about water and some you know, ideas of getting oneself or one's family prepared for their water supply and needs. We've talked about thinking the considerations that go into a safe zone, what location will be safe, how will you get there, how far away will that location be, is only thinking about one location sufficient, or should we think about alternate locations and alternate routes about how to get there? We've talked a little about how do we communicate with family and friends to maybe meet at safe locations in these eventualities. One thing that we haven't talked about yet, and it's something that I think is a little ironic, that we always think about the water and food as being basic essentials for human survival, and we tend to forget about the absolute most important one, the one that if we went without, we would perish from the fastest, and that's air supply. And I think there are some things we should consider to be prepared along those routes as well. Do you have some thoughts there, maybe?
I think that if people are going to prepare by, you know, creating bunkers in their backyard, underground, or something along those lines, then that is something that they really need to take into consideration. They need to have closed air units with a tremendous amount of filtration, you know, on several levels, because, you know, air may very well be an issue someday, you know, for a variety of reasons, and I think you're absolutely correct. And not only that, but I think people should have some air tanks in the house on hand just in case, whether it be for a fire or something simple along those lines, or something more hazardous like, you know, gas, or like we were talking about earlier, nuclear. Not that that would help much, but, you know, every little bit helps, you know.
Yes. Yep.
So I think that that's a very good point.
And even along the lines of a humble budget, like for myself, in fact, working from a very meager budget, but to make sure that we have some of those masks on hand, kind of like the medical type or the surgical mask. I think folks will know what I mean when I describe it that way. But with those folks, there are varying grades or degrees of those masks. And in other words, that means what types of stuff that they help filter out. Are they strong enough, or are they made constructed in such that they can help prevent some of the biological transfer, whether it's virus type stuff or the little bugs in the air? Here I'm showing my ignorance of the medical field, Nia, and I feel so badly given your great experience there.
But I think quite all right. A lot of people don't know about, you know, those type of grades, so I'm just basically going to put it in lay terms. Basically, you want to, if you're going to just buy regular, like, masks, you know, like medical masks, I would probably invest in something that's going to have the most filtration. You know, they're really not that expensive, so I'm sure you can buy a bunch of boxes of them. But if we're talking about, like, biological warfare or something like that, you definitely want to get suits or some kind of gas mask, I would say, if you were going to truly invest in something like that. But if you didn't have the money and that's all you could do, definitely they have, like, in the surgical and an OR, they have like these kind of paper jumpsuits that you can put on. They usually use them for people that are doing like construction or something in the operating rooms that have to be in, you know, at least a clean attire. So they make them wear that, but it prevents, you know, a lot of things, pathogens from getting out and pathogens from getting in. It's not totally sterile, but it's better than nothing. So that might be something to help. And again, those are fairly cheap, so that is a good option to keep on hand, especially if there's, like, you know, like in Katrina, there was, and I hate to say this on the radio, but there were a lot of dead bodies around, and that is not something that you want your children to be touching or yourself to be touching. A lot of people contract infections and disease, and they come in contact with bodily fluids that they don't want to, and it's not pretty, but it has to be said. So
quite right, quite right. And so once again, folks, even working from the humblest of budgets, it's very low cost to have some of these you know, surgical type masks or these medical type masks on hand. It's very inexpensive. I found that out personally again. And yet, to have those on hand will give you one additional leg up, in particular if you yourself or someone in your family suffers from any number of allergies. And another layer of consideration there is maybe you have someone who suffers from asthma. Do you have enough, whether it's inhalers or whatever other method of you know, sort of working with asthma or other respiratory-based issues, do you have enough of those medicines or those inhalers or other relief means on hand to last an extended period of time. You know, if there were one of these sort of disasters that happened in your part of the world, the grocery store shelves as well as the dime store and pharmacy shelves, they'll empty fairly quickly. So do you have a reserve of these critical things on hand that you can take care of that? If it's the nature of the emergency is such that people, families, are closed up in their homes, and one member of your family becomes ill, I think that's where Nia's example of having at least one or two, and they're very low cost. You can get these suits made of paper or lightweight plastic for only about $10. So you can have, for as low as $10, you can have a couple of those on hand just in case you need to be working with or treating medically someone in your family that has contracted something that the rest of the folks in the family have not contracted yet. And then going back to Nia's earlier point also about air supply, folks, if you have suffer from allergens or if you have asthma or any of these other respiratory conditions such that the quality of your air is important, how would you handle that again if there is a protracted or prolonged loss of electrical power to your home? The current measures that you use now would be unavailable to you. So also electrical generation in the home. Now, whether that is solar power supply, folks, with solar, you have to spend a lot of money to get to the level of power output where you can power your entire home. So unless you have a lot of money to work with, you can't think in those terms. But you can get equipped with a solar power supply that is relatively modest. It will allow you to power and recharge some of the basic things that you need. You can't run your refrigerator off it, but you can run some of these other key things that might very well make the difference either in life or death or quality of life for yourself, depending upon your own medical circumstances. Nia, any thoughts along those lines?
Yes. I think that people with allergies need to make sure that they have reserves of EpiPens or epinephrine on hand in case of severe anaphylaxis or anything like that or along those lines. You know, if you have concerns about that, talk to your doctor and tell them, you know, tell them your plan you're getting prepared for, you know, just getting prepared for a catastrophe or something like that. And they'll probably agree with you and provide you with an extra prescription, maybe a single extra prescription, but an extra prescription for, you know, something along the lines of epinephrine, which is very important if you have allergies to foods or, you know, anything basically. So a lot of doctors will go ahead and would be glad to give you an extra prescription for something like that. Again, with people that have medicines that are dependent on these medicines, like heart medications or, you know, something along those lines, epileptics have to take medication all the time to prevent seizures. So, again, those are people that need to make sure that they have reserves of their medicines on hand. Again, people that are, you know, maybe mothers that are breastfeeding or that are no longer breastfeeding need to make sure that they have a supply of formula for their children, you know, just extras. You know, formula is expensive. I can't believe the prices on that stuff.
Oh, my.
But also, just basically make sure to have a first aid kit. Basic first aid kits come with Band-Aids and alcohol swabs and, you know, stuff along those lines. If you can put some extras in there to kind of doctor it up, that's even better. In my first aid kits, I have smelling salts, you know, just in case somebody faints. You know, that way you don't have to rush them to the hospital if it's not necessary. You know, just basic things, tweezers, flashlights. Also, a box of gloves is cheap, and you get, like, 100 pairs in them. Gloves can be a lifesaver. They really can. You can use them for a variety of things. You know, people in the military can attest to that. You know, when they're out in the battlefield, they have a lot of uses for your basic stuff. So I
certainly
think that that's really, really good.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's at this point that due to time considerations, folks, Nia and I could go into a tremendous amount of detail with some of these supplies. You know, she had made mention or reference to flashlights, and not just flashlights, but do you have enough batteries on hand to power the flashlights and power your emergency radio, which is another example of something you should have. Portable radio that can either be operated by hand crank to recharge its batteries and or other. Folks, it is a tremendous list of detailed considerations, and this is where I'd like to point you again toward internet-based resources. Now, very curiously, about 6 weeks back, our own United States Centers for Disease Control issued a bulletin and a set of information web-based resources that they described to the public as being prepared for a zombie apocalypse. A zombie apocalypse. Now that sounds pretty. Provocative, I think, and in fact, you know, the Centers for Disease Control themselves said that what they were really striving to do is to generate interest and get people to pay attention about preparedness. Not, of course, that they feel that there will be a zombie apocalypse, but that if they just referred to tornado or hurricane preparedness, everyone would be asleep at the wheel. It wouldn't get their attention. So that's their claim. And yet, you know what I think is interesting is that the Army itself has issued a field manual in the course of that span of time. That field manual itself points toward being prepared in the event of zombie attack. Now, that gets my yellow flag and perhaps my red flag up even. What I'd like you to think about is this. Zombies in the traditional sense, like the movies, etc., no. But what happens to a people, a population, whether it's a city or whether it's an entire country, a population that has become as profoundly prescribed to various forms of medication, whether they might be the mood-altering type, whether we're talking about drugs like Prozac and all of these others. Also, what happens to a population that is addicted to nicotine and caffeine? What happens to those millions of people if suddenly those supply lines are limited or entirely cut off again? Think about yourself. If you've tried to quit tobacco cold turkey or caffeine cold turkey, if you've tried to drop off of some of these prescription drugs that you might be on and you've experienced some of those interactions, how it can affect your health, your mental state. Well, folks, think what happens if millions of people suddenly no longer have access to those various substances that we have become, well, accustomed to and for some of us addicted to. When millions of people suddenly don't have those, I guess your humble host would like to propose to you that that might very well represent the equivalent of a zombie apocalypse. So I'd like you to do a web search. Go to the website for the Centers for Disease Control. You can do a Google or a Yahoo search for CDC, the acronym, CDC Zombies, and that by itself should be enough to get you directly to the page that has, again, a tremendous listing of the resources, the details that Nia and I just don't have time to try to cover them all, but we'll give you a good grounding on some of those preparedness considerations for those events. And Nia, I know I've been talking here for quite a while. I want to make sure I don't hear my own voice for a little bit. Any thoughts along those lines, as provocative or sensationalistic as a zombie attack might sound, but any thoughts along those lines?
You know, you said you were talking about things kind of going in through one ear and out the other, and I couldn't agree more. Sometimes when people talk about preparedness, it's just, you know, a giant snooze. You're like, wow, listen to this pill, you know?
Exactly.
You know, I'd rather be on my phone texting or something, and you don't really pay attention, and because it's not provocative, it's not enticing, it's not an attention grabber, but it will be an attention grabber when it comes down to it, you know, and another thing that I'm going to appeal to whoever's listening that's maybe in medicine or, you know, not even just medicine, but a civil kind of career, something along the lines of, you know, an emergency operator or, you know, emergency services or police officer. People in the medical field and in those fields, they know firsthand, and I'm going to appeal to you guys. They know firsthand how people can change in the face of fear. And people do not underestimate the power of fear over people. It turns them very primal. And you would not believe the things that people would do because they were simply afraid. I mean, they get very aggressive and do things, their personality changes. I can't tell you how many times I've had patients, I mean, just, you would just not believe. I could sit here forever and tell you stories, but the point is that these people will later come back once they've calmed down and, I mean, just apologize through, you know, just like an hour of apologies because they just couldn't believe how they reacted themselves to something that was so simple, but that truly, truly scared them at that time, you know. And fear is a powerful weapon, you know, and if people are in mass hysteria, you definitely want to learn how to either A, avoid them, or B, deal with them. And something to take into consideration is self-defense, not even just you as an adult learning for you, your husband, your girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, but also your children. Your children need to learn how to be able to be okay just in case you were not there to protect them. So I think involving your kids in things like karate or sports, something to show them some kind of self-defense or self-sufficiency is a good thing. So I think that those are absolutely great points that you were making.
And fantastic thoughts that you've added along those lines as well, Nia. You know, you got my mind thinking on several different directions through the course of what you've shared. And I think, you know, Hurricane Katrina, once again, provides us a pretty crisp example of just exactly how quickly we can lose our courtesies, our politeness, the simple kindnesses that we show to one another on a daily basis. I think that provides us an example of how quickly some of those things can erode away. Would that be fair to say?
I think that that is true on many levels. However, I think that in the face of danger and catastrophe and just total upheaval, I think that you will find a lot of people become very close. I mean, I can't even tell you how many neighbors I've gotten to know because our power went out during a hurricane season, or they came over because their window broke, or, you know, they needed someplace safe to be, or, you know, where I lived during a hurricane, we all lost our electricity, like I told you, for about 2 months. And so we all had this food, all of this food that we had to get rid of because it wasn't going to last in our freezers and refrigerator. So what we did was we did like a cookout for like a bunch of the houses on our block.
Very cool.
Everybody ended up coming out and just everybody was so wonderful. But that's in a lighter scenario. But yeah, in a worst case scenario, you have to be very careful because you know what? Public services will be there to kind of control the crowd, not to protect you. They're going to be there
right.
to protect the interests of the greater people, and that'll be to control the greater people. So that will not be to your benefit. So I think that that is definitely something to consider.
Quite right. You're absolutely right. And you make a great point, and I'm so thankful that you did, that oftentimes, you know, these sort of events, these catastrophes or these disasters can draw people together. And we have examples of that also from Katrina. I've read stories about how different folks who, when they were seeking safety in the Superdome, that there were folks that had never met one another before, but they remain in close contact, almost like family, even today, and I'm sure that will continue on into the future. And yet I think it also illustrates for us that, you know, people are just wired differently. And you have some folks who are wired that these sort of unexpected events will draw them together, will bring out the best in them. And unfortunately, we also have from history those examples of the people that are wired the other way, where uncertainties and danger and these hazards bring out the worst in them. And we saw that happening throughout the streets of New Orleans as a result of Katrina. And folks, ladies and gentlemen of my listening audience, you know from my past shows that I'm not afraid to say that also the members of our society services, the police force themselves, oftentimes, I shouldn't say oftentimes, but in some cases, they were of the type that it brought out the worst in them, and that we saw some of the ugly side of human behavior coming from those representatives of law enforcement, from the fields of medicine, but also from elected leadership as well. So I guess the moral of the story is that until you know someone and have been through this sort of unexpected catastrophe or disaster with them, then you maybe don't really know them at all. And we don't know if they're wired in the first way, which is where this will bring out the best in them, or if they're wired in the other way, which is where it would bring out the worst in them potentially. But Nia, any other thoughts along these lines, some of these topics we've covered here in the last section?
I just wanted to add really quickly, you know, when we were talking about self-defense for the family, I think it's very important, especially for the girls. You know, a lot of times in a family where there's mixed male and female, a lot of times there's a lot of, okay, well, the boys will protect us and kind of along those thought lines. But
yes,
it's really important for girls to be kind of proactive in that area too, because it's really important for them to be able to defend themselves. And for as far as teaching kids how to defend themselves only in worst-case scenarios like we've been talking about, I think that an easier way to do that is take them to play archery one weekend, you know, or a couple weekends. That's something simple, maybe even paintballing if you have some teenagers. You know, it's simple, but it provides them with skills that they can later refer to if they really needed it. You know, again, martial arts is a great thing. It provides them with exercise. It gets them away from the video games and the texting, and, you know, and it provides them with a sense of accomplishment as well. You know, I think that those are great things to do, and you should take those things into consideration, because I think that those are important as well.
Those are just excellent examples, Nia. You know, the martial arts or some of these other, you know, paintballing, for example. Physical activities, folks, you know, those accomplish multiple tasks all in one movement. They get our kids active, involved, exercising, relating with other young people of their same age, networking, if you will, in that sense, building their social skills. And at the same time, it's preparing them with some basic skills and ideas about preparation that hopefully will never come into play or need to in their lifetime. And yet, once again, if you were in the tornado-stricken regions this year, the wildfire regions, the flooding regions, all of these sorts of things that could happen and do happen every single year and every day in some part of the world, in those unlikely or unhoped-for events, they would have a degree of preparedness that otherwise they would not if we just let them stay in front of the TV and the Xbox and et cetera. So excellent, excellent points, Nia. Thank you there, too.
You're welcome.
One area that we hadn't really covered yet, and I want to make sure that we cover this area also with some thoughts, is food itself. What are some of the steps that people can begin taking, maybe as quickly as this very day, to make sure that they are prepared and have preparedness for their family with regard to food supply?
I'm actually glad you brought that up, because what I'm going to say is going to touch base on several of the things that we've been talking about in all the areas that we've been talking about. One of them is that stockpiling a supply of food is important. It's right up there with air and water. You know, if you can survive a while without food, but food is essential, especially if you have children or things along those lines. You know, people that really depend on you to really feed them. And it's also important to keep your energy supply up. It's important for your health. It's just important. So basically, it's expensive to stockpile food. However, if you do it intelligently, you know, then you can stockpile a mass amount of supplies. You know, it'll still cost you something, but it won't be as much. A lot of things that I've been taking into consideration lately as I've considered my preparations is you see all these new shows now on super couponing. Again, YouTube is a great resource as well, because everybody, it's just filled with people that are doing these things, and I just find it so inspiring, because these people are super couponing and they're stocking up on all this stuff, and they have this huge stockpile that they wouldn't, you know, and it's cheaper for them to do it that way. So not only are they saving money, but they're getting two things done at once. They're saving money that could be useful in other areas, and they're stockpiling food while saving money. I mean, what can be better than that?
Exactly.
So, another thing that I wanted to bring up as well is, you know, when we were talking about basically getting back to basics, learning how to do things, and also about children and teaching them things, is teaching them how to make things for themselves, making bread, like you brought up. You know, making bread, my aunt and I, we do it. And, you know, let me tell you something. Not only do I get to spend valuable time with my family, but it's fun. I know how to do something that not many people know how to do. Another thing I know that I get to do with my family, you know, that I value and truly cherish that a lot of people in my generation just do not know how to do anymore is things like canning and preserving. And I'm still learning those things. But these things are not going to be very useful for you in a book, in a case of an emergency, if you don't actually know how to do them. You know, it's like do one, see one, teach one kind of a thing. And I'm sure I mixed that all up, but you get my point.
Absolutely.
So I think that it's really important to get your kids involved and get your family involved or even learn how to do it just for yourself, you know, and you get to preserve a massive amount of food that way. And it'll stay good and it's better because you know what's going into it. You know, you're not getting all of this genetically modified food, and I could totally go into that. That's a whole other segment, I'm sure, but...
You make excellent points about, exactly what you said, whether it's canning or preserving your foods that maybe you've grown in your own garden. You said it so aptly. You can't just pick up a book and start doing it. First, there are some supplies involved, the mason-type jars themselves, I'm trying to think of what you call it, is it a pressure cooker or a steamer or something along those lines?
Well, you can do it in a regular pot, but you have to have, like, this little metal rack so that the jars don't touch the bottom of the pot. But, you know, those things are fairly cheap, and mason jars or ball jars or whatever, they're cheap. You can buy a big case of them for, like, $6.
Yeah.
And they come with the tops and the little lids and everything. And, you know, just practice with it. But preserving your own food will save you a lot of money. And you can create a huge pantry of stuff to just, you know, even if you're not preparing, it's a good way to save money, you know.
Exactly.
And it's just a great thing to know how to do.
You bet. But once again, the key is to start today, because once again, if we are in the midst of one of these events, however tragic and much we would hope that they don't occur, many of those items will be the first ones that leave the store shelves from people who've already been doing it and they just want to add to their supply. So it is well worth the time to not just have a book on hand that describes how to do it, but go ahead and acquire some of those supplies and get practice. Get started practicing. Work out the trial and error aspects of it today as opposed to trying to work them out after it's already become time where those things are needed. And Nia, I wanted to add to that list as well some of these food preparedness things. Folks, it's as simple as your next trip to the grocery store. If that's 10 minutes from now or in the next week, canned goods. A lot of your favorite canned foods that you already have been using and have loved all of your life, have more on hand. Buy twice as many as you were going to buy before you thought about this program or this preparedness. Campbell's soup. It lasts an awful long time, folks, in the can. Go ahead and have some of your favorites on hand, just more of them. There's also multiple different routes to go in terms of dehydrated and or freeze-dried type foods. Your humble host has taken advantage of one company's products, and again, I'm not paid to make this product placement, but maybe I'll send a clip of this to them and see if we can't get something done. But eFoods Direct is one company that I've done business with. They provide dehydrated foods. My loved one and I are big fans of their chili and tortilla soups, and we bought a box that we can have on hand that will give us more than 50 meals of either one of those at a cost that fits right into our budget of when we go to the store and try to do our purchasing on our budget. It fits right into that cost structure of what we would spend per meal for any of the things that we buy, you know, on a day-to-day basis at the store. So there are a lot of those options that once you start to do your homework, you'll find some things that not only do they fit into your preparedness plan, but they fit into your budget as well. My other thought along those lines is how do you prepare those different foods? What if we are without electricity for multiple days or multiple weeks at a time? How do you go about cooking and preparing foods? Nia, any thoughts along those lines?
Yes. Again, the foods and the cans and the jars, that comes into place. You know, I had no idea you can cook chicken and bread in jars and seal them away. How weird is that? But you can do it. And yeah. You wouldn't need to cook it. You know, it might not taste that great, but you'll survive. You know, again, these things are, you can create whole meals, soups, stews, chilies, like you were saying. You can put those in cans or get them freeze-dried, or you can invest in a dehydrator. Some of them are very inexpensive, and you can freeze-dry a bunch of fruits and vegetables and, you know, use them as chips or whatever. You can rehydrate them later and eat them then. You can do a lot of things. And also, I wanted to add something that I forgot to mention earlier. When you are looking for resources, again, you know, a lot of people don't like to coupon. They think, oh, it's embarrassing. I used to be one of those people, too. I'm still kind of teetering on the edge of that. I'm like, you know what? But once you see how much you can save and put towards other things, it will amaze you. Again, online resources, great. Other resources you can go to for, you know, to learn things in general is your local community center. You would be surprised how many classes and seminars and things like that they offer for either free or cheap. Again, your newspaper, your local health food stores, they all have calendars of events. And again, a lot of their classes are very informative. They have a lot of guest speakers that are very knowledgeable in their topics. And again, they're very either free or they're very cheap to attend. And it's also something interesting. You can meet a lot of different people, make friends. Networking is another good thing because you never know who might be useful to you in terms of knowledge, skills, or contacts, acquaintances, and whatnot. And those are things that you definitely want to hold on to. So, yes, you have been just an enormous amount of points.
More great considerations also, Nia, from you. I certainly appreciate having your expertise and experience as part of the program today. And folks, we've kind of talked about food here for a bit. I think that out of all of these different aspects or areas of preparedness, the food one is maybe going to be the easiest for you to get to work on solving. Not only does the CDC website on the zombie apocalypse talk about food considerations, but also, you know, there are so many companies now. I made mention of the one that I've made a purchase from, eFoods Direct. There are so many others. That's not the only. I think there's another brand, Mountain House, that offers a wide range of product supply as well. There are also a number of different canned food options that are of larger size, more bulk, in other words. Did you realize you can get canned bacon that's actually pre-prepared? It's kind of like the stuff that I use because I'm lazy that I get from the store and I don't want to cook the bacon from start to finish. They have pre-cooked bacon, and it actually I've got some of this on the way to me. That you can get it in a canned format so that it's lasting perhaps 20 years on the shelves. You can get canned ground beef, canned sausage and roast beef and turkey and chicken, like in 2-pound size cans so that it's more so ready and able to help when you're preparing food for an entire family or a larger group. Those things are available. Do your research out there. There's lots of places that supply those things. But what I'm thinking is very important for us to talk about now is how do you cook those things? Once again, if that power goes out, if you can't use the electric stove, or if the gas supply to your house is interrupted, so you can't use, if it is gas heating or gas cooking that you use, what are your other considerations? Well, folks, there's the good old-fashioned charcoal grill. The question is, do you have enough reserves of charcoal on hand to be able to use that as a cooking option for perhaps weeks or months at a time? So stocking up with your charcoal and the other supplies that you might use in that regard. Please keep in mind that, because I've heard some folks say, oh, if it worse comes to worse, I'll just burn wood in the grill and cook over that. Well, did you realize, folks, that many of the types of wood that you might find, if you try to burn that and cook over that, you might very well be inviting in some health issues or concerns that could make things worse rather than better, unless you've done your homework about exactly what type of wood you would be attempting to burn in that regard. Another option, aside from the good old-fashioned charcoal grill, would be propane. Many of us do have propane gas grills that we use, but once again, do you have a reserve of that on hand? Do you have more than one tank, a backup supply? Another great consideration that many folks use who are seasoned campers, there are small propane grill type formats. They use the smaller cylinders, but there are some companies that make conversion kits so that you might have one of those small or portable type grills, and that might be essential because it might be difficult to transport your full-size grill. They use conversion kits where you can use a larger tank on the smaller options. And now, one other option that I'm not sure about. Nia, I'm curious. Nia, have you heard about solar ovens?
I have. I do know that they take forever to cook something, but it is a viable option. I personally would prefer to just have all my food pre-cooked in jars or something.
Well, actually, Nia, from my research that I've done, I've found that there are different types of solar ovens where it doesn't take forever. It really kind of comes down essentially to what time of year it is, what level of radiation we're getting, where the sun's at in the sky, in other words. In the winter months where we have the sun is low to the horizon, there's less direct radiation, that's where you can run into some long cooking times. Folks, if you haven't already, make a note, solar ovens, do a Yahoo or a Google search, begin to do some research. You can construct one at home using supplies that you have yourself. There are people in the world right now who their only option, their only ability to cook at high temperatures like an oven is to use exactly this concept, solar ovens. They don't have the luxuries that we have in the West. They don't have the gas or electric resources to power ovens. It's their only option, and they use it quite successfully. These solar ovens can allow you to cook at upwards of 450 degrees temperature. It is also widely held that solar ovens cook the food that you're preparing more evenly than any of our Western technological conveniences, because most of those involve radiative convection of heating. Solar ovens cook food very, very evenly, very thoroughly. So depending upon the item you're preparing, that might be a greater or lesser consideration. But again, solar ovens can be almost free. You can make them yourself in your own backyard. On the Internet, you can find lots of resources, kits and plans about how to construct them. And there are also companies that sell them as well. And once again, this is not a paid product placement, but I just want to make you aware that depending upon how severe the experience might be, we may not have access to electricity or even to propane gas. Our supply line of that might run out for some length of time. And in those eventualities, you could still feed your family with something, albeit less convenient, but still very effective and used in the world today, these solar ovens, if you'll do some homework there. Any thoughts along these lines, Nia?
No, I think you've covered it. That's very true. And I think you can make solar ovens out of quite a few things. So I think you're right on the money on that one.
You bet. Well, you know, Nia, I guess we've had a chance to cover a pretty wide range here, more wide-ranging even than I thought our conversation might get to be. But let me ask you this. Through the range of what we've covered, maybe we've left something out, or maybe there's another piece that deserves a little more thorough explanation. Any thoughts from your perspective here at this point to make sure we've covered the bases of preparedness?
Well, I think we've covered, like you said, a very good wide range of things, you know, and these people, these are just the basics. I mean, like I said, nothing surmounts your getting yourself informed, you know, educating yourself, doing your own research. And also, again, I do want to emphasize, like I did at the beginning, the most important thing that you will do with your whole preparedness thing will probably be to find a location. That, again, is the most important. And one thing I wanted to add about the Vivos, and again, I want to remind everybody that I'm not being paid by them, but I didn't know if you were aware, but Vivos, they supply clothing and enough food for, I think a year or 2 years. So, I mean, that's included. So basically with Vivos, all you have to do is show up. If you're fortunate enough to be able to afford them, you know, I think that it's a good option. So, yeah, when I read their website, I was like, wow, they provide clothes?
That's thorough, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
And folks, although neither Nia nor myself are getting compensated by them, just in case you wanted to follow up and go to that website, we've been saying the name, but I don't think we've spelled it. I think the Vivos part is V-I-V-O-S. Is that right, Nia?
It's Terra, like the Latin word for land, T-E-R-R-A, and Vivos like life, V as in Victor, I-V-O-S.
Excellent, yes. And folks, once again, at the very least, that can serve as a part of a pre-plan for you to think through how your preparedness plan for your family should look and be. And for many folks out there, maybe that is your perfect solution as well. And if it is, when you contact them and sign up, please tell them that Antonin and Nia sent you it so that maybe maybe we'll get something back out of the process. But
you know, one thing I did want to ask the audience is if anybody has suggestions or comments, or if anybody knows of other shelters or places for people to go, other, you know, organizations, or just another place in general, it would be great to let other people know. So please do not hold that kind of information back and share with everybody.
Absolutely. That's a great point, Nia. And in fact, folks, when I'm hoping that we have some open line time for callers to call in to BBS Radio as part of this broadcast. If not, one of my upcoming programs, I'm going to reserve at least a segment of the show to do exactly that. Perhaps Nia can join me on the bridge through the studio to take some of your calls, answer questions, be able to interact in that way. We might even try to do that on today's program, since this is a pre-record. We're not sure how the time works out. But another avenue would be through the websites. For example, bbsradio.com has a set of forums. The Crimson Pill radio program, we have a channel on YouTube. That channel name is Crimson Pill TV on YouTube, where you could post comments and or send messages to myself. My direct email is antonin@thecrimsonpill.com. And we're happy to serve as relays of this sort of information and discussion to help foster the process of folks getting prepared. So I definitely appreciate those thoughts also, Nia. And, you know, as we kind of close, Nia, my thoughts turn back to one of the very first analogies that you provided earlier in the program about how people with different aspects of our life, we do plenty of preparedness, whether it's buying car or home insurance, life insurance, medical health insurance. And yet it's interesting that when it comes to this sort of direct preparedness, the air, the water, the food that we need to survive if these unexpected things last more than just a few days, it causes me to think about folks that I've had in my life that when it comes to their vacation, let's say it's a trip out to California, to Disney, they invest more time, effort, and energy in their planning process for that simple vacation trip than what they've even begun to apply toward preparedness for their family. And so, folks, once again, think not just about what sort of things you can acquire, the food, the water, etc., batteries for the flashlights, etc., that you can set aside, but how can you prepare each member of your family so that if they should become separated from the family as a whole, then individually they will be prepared enough, have a communication plan as to how they can get connected to you. They have their own map so that they can see the routes necessary to make it into the company of family and friends. How can you prepare each person who is important to you in your life in this way? And the last thought that I had among my notes, Nia, is something that we didn't cover would be some monetary reserve also. You know, we've talked about having gas on hand and the car ready to go and alternate routes laid out. But listening audience, how many of us have a set-aside envelope of $100 or $200 that we know that we won't touch unless it's an extreme emergency. Well, just like what we're talking about now. Nia, any thoughts also along those lines with having some money set aside, things of that nature, kind of that direction about preparedness from your standpoint?
You know, that's a great point and one that I totally forgot about myself. I wanted to mention about having, in this economy, it's really difficult to save money, let alone prepare for another thing that's very expensive. But I think that if, like, you listen to this program and you kind of take our advice or just take your own advice, you know, you can save money and do this. Everybody can do this. Okay, but as far as money goes, I think that it is important, along with your stockpile of things, not to just have money, Antonin, but also to have things of value. So if things, again, I always think in worst case scenario terms, so if things got really bad, you could have things to barter with or
Excellent.
Things of value to trade. Things like if you have an investment in gold or silver, keep those on hand. Keep spare jewelry, even if you don't want it, just keep it because it's valuable. If you have alcohol or something, even if you don't drink, keep it. It's a good bartering tool. Things like chocolate, simple things that we think are simple, things other people may not have in a worst-case scenario may afford you something else that you don't have and need. So things to have for bartering as well as money is very important, and you know, as a monetary system kind of thing. So yes, I agree.
Those are absolutely great points that you've made, absolutely, because so often in an extreme set of circumstances like what we've been referring to, the most important thing may have nothing to do with printed currency, you know, our U.S. dollars. It might very well be some of these things that people need themselves or want themselves, and they in turn are willing to trade with us things that we or want very much for ourselves or our family. And just to add one more thought along those lines, you're right that gold and silver would be, you know, ideal things to have on hand, actual coinage, which, folks, our U.S. Mint produces what they call American Eagles. They're gold coins. There's also silver American Eagles. And then there's also, I'm trying to think of the term that they use for it, numismatic currency. So it's these are older coins. They're collectibles. Oftentimes they've already been circulated in currency. And as a matter of fact, that's one layer of the preparedness that I have done for myself, is I have a very small, very humble reserve of gold coinage, but especially some silver coinage on hand. And if you're operating from a humble budget like I have myself, folks, keep in mind that there's what they call junk silver. Now, they call it that because it is older U.S. coinage. It's pre-1965 coinage, like silver dollars, even quarters and dimes. But pre-1965, those were made with 90% actual silver. And so that's why they refer to it as junk silver, is because it's not 0.999 pure, but it is 90% pure silver. And an awful lot of you, if you're anything like my folks at home, they have a couple of huge cans of coins, of change. Every time they've had change from a trip back from a shopping trip, they pour it into these things and they just seem to save it forever and ever. You might very well have a reserve of some 90% pure junk silver coinage, and you've been unaware of it. So look for pre-1965. And then you might also want to do a little homework and just verify that particular coin actually is junk silver. But what you need to understand about that is that silver today, I think the spot price on silver is north of $36 an ounce. And so if you have a pre-1965 silver dollar, rather than being worth $1, which is what the face value is, that silver dollar might very well be worth something like $32 or $34 right now today, and maybe worth more in the future. So please do a little work on that end, because Nia is absolutely right. Paper dollars themselves might become worth almost nothing. Even if you have 1,000 of them set aside in an emergency like this, chocolate or alcohol or nicotine might be worth more than those paper dollars. But very definitely some gold or some silver coinage will be worth quite a lot more than them, and will be more easy to transact and barter with, most definitely. So, Nia, once again, I talked for so long there, I sure apologize, and I appreciate your patience.
No, not at all. You know, I was just thinking that it's super funny that you mentioned coins. My cousin and I, we were talking about that the other day, and I had no idea that he was somewhat of a amateur kind of connoisseur of coins. And he was telling me all of this fascinating stuff about, you know, different types of coins and just how people never know what they have. Because a lot of our currency used to be pure copper or pure nickel or pure silver, like you were saying, and we've had pure gold coins and stuff like that. And a lot of us, or even coins that have been out of mint for a long time, are worth, I mean, just huge amounts of money, and they're worth a lot to people because, you know, they represent times and things like that, that, you know, things were different. But it's just, it's so amazing. So if anybody ever gets a chance to talk to someone who's knowledgeable about coins, listen to them, because they have just such a plethora of information. And it's fascinating because, yes, metal is a great tool for bartering, not just gold and silver, but things like copper and aluminum too. You know, has anybody seen the prices of copper? It's just outrageous. Copper is super expensive now, and it's because, you know, people need it, and copper is useful for a great many things. So if you have some spare copper, you know, my dad, he's in AC repair and stuff like that, and he accumulates copper, and so, you know, he gets to save it and stuff like that. So the little odds and ends, he gets to save. So, I mean, that's a great thing to have on hand, because copper, like I said, is always useful. It's a great conductor of, like, you know, and so it's very, very good.
Excellent points once again, Nia. And it truly has been my pleasure and privilege to host you on the show. I'm so very thankful that you initiated our correspondence with that message, talking about preparedness and that it would make a good show topic. I'm so thankful for that. And listeners out there, I'm sure many of you have so many ideas and experiences on this subject that Nia and I have not had the opportunity to cover today, and we hope that you'll share those ideas with us. Nia, as our closing thought here, if you have just a moment to be able to express to any mother or father who's listening right now, any sister, any brother, any son or any daughter, why it's important that they should get started with their preparedness planning today, how would you express that?
I would probably express it in a way of catering to their emotions by telling them, you know, in all honesty and completely sincerely, I don't know what I would do without my family. And so if something happened and I were to survive for whatever reason, and my family didn't, I would just be the most miserable person on this planet. So just keeping my family safe and making sure that they're aware is super important to me. Now, a lot of people, they don't want to, a lot of people think that it's a lot of hoo-ha and a lot of, you know, kind of people getting all hyped up about nothing, and they think it's a lot of conspiracy theories, but what I have to tell you is, you know what? Nobody ever thinks it's going to happen to them until it does. And our history has a way of proving that things repeat themselves. And I am not totally closed off to the idea that anything is possible. You know, and I think that people that aren't open to that are going to be in for a rude awakening at some point. And I think that it's important to appeal to your family if they don't agree with you. And, you know, in the sense of being prepared for certain events, I think that it's important to appeal to their better natures, appeal to them emotionally. What would you do if you didn't have your child or something like that, or your husband or whatnot around? How would you, you know, go through life? How would you prepare your children? How would you, you know, there's a whole wide way, you know, a wide variety of ways to explain to people. Just, again, it's all about appealing to them. And so I think that that's also important because, like I said, a lot of people, they just don't they don't make themselves aware, or they hear about it and they just brush it off. And we're so used to our way of life that we've become blind to a lot of things, a lot of issues, and a lot of possibilities. So I think that by letting people know, protect your loved ones, protect your family, protect your friends, and protect yourself, and do the right thing, you know?
Well, Nia, that it is so very well said. And just on, a personal note, I would like to thank you not just for your interest in the subject and sharing that with me via email as a show topic, but I also want to thank you for the place of consciousness that you've been speaking from. And you've done a great deal of homework, if you will, preparing even, you know, just for our show, for our discussion. And that's indicative to me of the place of consciousness that you come from. And you are working and you're investing your own time as a student in the field of medicine. You're a healer and you're working in that field and applying your own energies on a daily basis, and then also your course of studies to prepare for maybe another role in medicine as a doctor. And it's something that I want to thank you for, very much so, that you've attributed your time and energy and resources. And you're out of your concern, not just for your own family and friends, but for your fellow public in general, your fellow man, if you will, or humanity in whole. And so I thank you for that. And we at the Crimson Pill wish you the very, very best in the course of your studies as you continue in the field of medicine. And, Nia, I just want to thank you again so much for being a part of the program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And you know what? I really appreciate that. And I wanted to tell you guys something along the same lines. I completely admire and respect what you guys do on a daily basis. I really, you know, it just takes a lot to, you know, get the word out there, do what you're doing, have the kind of shows that you have, which I love, by the way. You guys have the best station. And I'm just so impressed by what you guys do, and I want to thank you for your service to humanity and tell you that it's really important and that it does not go unacknowledged. So thank you.
Well, Nia, thank you so very much. It's very kind of you to say, and I appreciate your sentiments so very much. So, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to our conversation with Nia Ruiz from Florida. A practicing professional in the field of medicine. We've been talking about preparedness. It is my hope that on either this Sunday's broadcast, again, Nia and I have pre-recorded this in accordance with her availability and her schedule, and yet it will be airing today when you're hearing this. It is Sunday, July the 17th. It's my hope that Nia will be able to join us either late in today's broadcast or maybe on an upcoming broadcast to maybe field some calls and questions as we continue a discussion of family preparedness, and hopefully have a chance to open the lines and hear from many of you as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to today's program. And please remember, we hope that this is just the beginning for you and your family, that you'll take advantage of the world at your fingertips via the internet, many of the websites and resources that Nia and I have alluded to through the course of the program. And ladies and gentlemen, if in fact you still require some measure of motivation above and beyond what Nia has already provided, please remember, if you're not willing to start in this path of preparedness for yourself, then please, please at the very least do it for your family, for your friends, for any of your loved ones. Thanks again, folks, for listening to The Crimson Pill.